From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today on the show, we highlight some of the year's best food books, debate over who makes the best hummus in Jerusalem, exploring the flavors of Burma, Jonathan Gold dissects the Southern biscuit, Susan Venegar talks street food, plus a food writer investigates why there are so few women chefs. But first, let's check in with Laura Avery at the Santa Monica Farmers Market to see what's fresh and in season this beautiful week in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're getting into the final phases of the major holiday season this year. Everybody's at the market looking for recipes to bake and share and enjoy with family and friends. Amelia Saltzman is here, as she always is when she's in town, and she's got a wonderful holiday cookie recipe that she wants to share with us. And Amelia, I tasted one already. It was delicious, seasonal, and absolutely guilt-free. So tell us all about it.
You know, we don't often think about holiday cookies and farmer's market in the same sentence, but this is one of my absolute favorite holiday cookies, gift cookie for the entire season. Tonight's the last night of Hanukkah. We've got Christmas coming. We've got New Year's. A lot of entertaining. And this is a caramel date walnut roll. So the starring ingredients are the new harvest crops, dates and walnuts that we find at the farmer's market. I learned this recipe from Marion Cunningham years ago, Fanny Farmer, but it really is a great thing. You can freeze them. It's just fantastic. So we're going to start with a pound of dates. I like to use halawi or hadrawi. You can use a fresh deglet as well, but you don't want to go too big. And you don't want to go too melty. So that means no baris and no medjools. Too huge. Pit them. And then stuff them with a new harvest walnut. If you don't have new harvest, fine. But they will really sing. And look for those halves. Put them in either vertically or horizontally and kind of press the soft date flesh around the walnut. And then you're going to make a little batter with sour cream and butter and sugar and so on, and a little flour. And this is the sticky, messy part. You're going to dip it in, you know, so that it kind of has a little bit of a cookie coating on it. And then you're just going to bake those, I think, like 375 for maybe 8 or 10 minutes.
So where does the caramel part of this recipe come in?
Well, very good question. Two places. One is the date itself. Dates have very caramel notes on their own. That's one place. The other place is, I forgot to say, let's use brown sugar instead of white sugar. So that already has sort of a caramel background. Here's the third place. When you take these little, wonderful little confections out of the oven, you're going to gild the lily. You're going to make a browned butter glaze and drizzle it over. It means you're going to put a few tablespoons of butter in a skillet. You're going to swirl it around over medium heat until it gets this nut brown. It has a nutty quality, but when you stir in sugar and then reheat that whole thing, you get a caramelized sensation. Drizzle that over and let them cool completely. Let these little confections cool completely. And then you can freeze them. You can pack them in with darling bags. And they're great hostess gifts. They're great teacher gifts. And they are starring ingredients from the farmer's market.
Amelia, thanks so much as always.
My pleasure.
That was Amelia Saltzman. She is the author of the Santa Monica Farmer's Market Cookbook. She's at the market every week continuing to gain inspiration and inspiring us with her recipes. Amelia was talking about the freshness of the dates, that it's important for her cookie recipe. So we're so excited. Today actually is the first week of the fresh harvest of California walnuts. And Christopher from Rancho Lavinia is here at the market. He is at many of the farmers markets selling fresh Santa Barbara walnuts. And Christopher, you've got the fresh crop. Let's talk about the flavor, the freshness. Sometimes people don't really like walnuts because they have a little bit of bitterness or some pith or something. Let's talk about all that with the walnuts. But first of all, I just had one of these fresh ones. They are sweet. You can still taste the oil. It's all delicious.
Real buttery. Yes. Those are coastal Paine walnuts, and they're an English varietal. And part of the reason we don't have that bitterness like you do out of some of the walnuts that come from the Central Valley is we have a cooler climate. Produces lower tannic acid and a sweeter nut.
Okay, and that, so the tannic acid is in the nut, but sometimes there's that weird skin or that, I don't know, almost like they you feel like you want to peel them or something before you eat them.
Well the skin's actually got the tannic acid in it and that little membrane that's in the middle. Of course, the membrane's removed when we shell the nut, but it does retain it, and the nuts from warmer climates tend to be a little sharper in the bite.
Mm-hmm. And these were harvested when?
November, late November, and we just got them in today. Today is our first day of the new crop.
You sell the walnuts in bags by the pound and the half pound, and you have the whole halves for people who really want to get fancy with their baking.
And then we have walnut oil. You don't want to forget that.
And when are you going to be pressing that?
We press the oil at different times of year. It's multiple times a year. It takes about 3.5 pounds of walnuts to make one of our 500 milliliter cans, and we toast them first and then cold press them.
Well, they are delicious. It's so exciting to have the first taste of the first walnut off the tree here in California. And then you're right across from Batista Dates, and he's got those dates Amelia was talking about. So this is just the perfect little nexus.
That's a great little marriage. It is.
It is. It really is. Okay, Christopher. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Christopher. He is the face of Rancho La Viña Walnuts. They are certified organic, by the way. They're grown in Santa Barbara. And to get the very freshest and best walnuts right off the tree, do come visit here. Any of the Rancho La Viña stands in Southern California. We're fortunate to have a nonprofit gleaning group called Food Forward that comes to the Santa Monica, Hollywood, and Studio City markets every week, and they pick up produce. They have already gleaned 50,000 pounds of produce in a very short period of time. They're looking for gleaner volunteers. So if you want to join this worthy organization, come to the farmers market and volunteer to help pick up produce and take it to needy people who are being fed fresh farmers market produce. Please do contact either KCRW or the Santa Monica Farmers Market to get more information about how to join the Glean team with Food Forward. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe for Amelia Saltzman's caramel date walnut rolls with brown butter glaze is on the Good Food blog. In place of our annual cookbook roundup, this year, we decided to do a whole show on our favorite books of 2012. 2012 has been an incredible bumper year for cookbooks, so we're happy to give these few a bit of a highlight. Our first segment highlights a book at the very top of my list. Noted restaurateurs Yotam Ottolenghi and Sammy Tamimi spent their childhoods on different sides of one beautiful, complicated city. Yotam grew up on the Jewish west side of Jerusalem, and Sammy on the Muslim east side. Years later, the two met in Europe. Yotam owns the Ottolenghi restaurants in London, where Sammy's a partner and executive chef. Their new book, Jerusalem, is truly one of the most exciting cookbooks I've seen in years. So Yotam and Sammy, for those of us who have never been to Jerusalem, can you give us a sense of what it's like to walk through the city food-wise? I imagine aromas coming from everywhere.
That is quite an accurate description. There is, like many other hot places, there is a lot of going on in the streets in terms of food. There is wonderful market stalls. There's bagel stands with freshly baked bread that you dip in za'atar. There is pomegranates sold juice on street corners. There's falafel stalls.
They sell also tamarind juice and almond juice.
Yes, and thickened milk puddings with coconut and walnuts. And there's just food everywhere you walk, and fresh food. And there's just this sort of, it's very difficult not to stop and eat on the way. I mean, it's just a sense that you have to stop every other second and eat something. And because there is such a large different number of different communities living in Jerusalem, there's Arabs and Jews and Christians, and each one has sort of got subdivisions. So every one of those cooks their own food. And just going into people's homes and seeing what they're doing is one of the most fascinating things you can do.
Are the foods related more to the religions or just to the diverse cultures?
It's not so much to do with religious. It's more of the culture and where these communities come from.
Yeah, I mean, religion plays a huge part in Jerusalem for good and very often for bad. But in terms of food, it's a cultural thing, because one of the things that you see is that, for instance, Jews that come originally from Arab countries like Syria or Iraq or Libya actually often cook foods that are actually very, very similar to what the indigenous Palestinians eat. They might have a different name or a slightly different variation, but it's more or less the same kind of food. So the divide is not so much on religion ground, but more on a cultural ground.
So let's talk first about what everyone shares. There's so many diverse cultures represented in the food of Jerusalem, but what dishes are shared by pretty much everyone?
There are certain things. I mean, it's very hard to say absolutely everyone, but there are certain things that absolutely you've got a good chance to encounter wherever you go. And this is one of the identifying dishes is the chopped up salad. You know, the cucumber, tomato are the basics, but you do find debates about about the size of the chunks. So people,
of course,
some people would have to have them tiny, and others want it more sort of bigger and rustic. So, as you can imagine, Jews and Arabs, they'll have to sort of argue about something. So that is the size of the chunks of the salad is actually quite crucial, and also within the communities.
I was going to say Jews are perfectly capable of arguing amongst themselves,
of creating their own fights. That absolutely, that's true. And then also there's the question of what you add to that salad, like whether there's za'atar, whether there's, you know, scallions, where you put red peppers or radishes and all those kind of
vinegar
things.
Vinegar or lemon juice.
Or both.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about another dish that it seems that probably as many people as there are in Jerusalem, there is a different opinion on how to make it, and that would be hummus.
You know, that's where to start. This is the question, because there's just so many variations and it goes in different directions. First of all, you know, there's arguments about who was the first to make hummus. And, you know, most people would agree to that the Palestinians were cooking hummus before Jews started coming to Israel or Palestine at the time. But then there's some guy, Meir Shalev, who is a famous Israeli author, who says he found some evidence in the Old Testament that actually Jews used to cook hummus before Arabs were around.
Hummus in Arabic means in Arabic hummus. So it could be that they cooked chickpeas, but they didn't cook hummus. So
it's impossible to say who was the first that made it. And then, so, you know, but people are very happy to fight over this over this question. And then there is the next stage is where you get the best hummus in town, which, again, this is another thing that people are very happy to argue. Even best friends might lose their friendship over the best hummus joint in town. So that's another thing. And, you know, and then recipes, whether it has to have lots of lemon juice or less lemon juice, how much tahini you add, and, you know, the consistency and the temperature and the condiments, and whether you top it with fava beans or with chickpeas or with raw onion. So there's just so many varieties and variations. And like anything else in Jerusalem, it all turns into a huge debate, and there is just no escaping it.
And it's all delicious.
No, yeah. I mean, the day isn't much different between the two sides. It's just they like to argue about it.
Now, let's talk about the various baked rings, whether it's Arab bread rings or various bagels.
I mean, in Jerusalem, the most common bagel that you see is the Arab one, which is sort of an elongated
ring. It's kind of
ring. Yeah, it's a bit like elliptic, and it's covered with sesame and baked in the oven. It's very light. It's got some oil in it as well.
Yeah, it's a very soft bagel. It's not like a hard bagel.
Yeah, it's not like the Jewish bagel. And normally they sell it in the Old City, in the Arab side, and you get a little pouch of newspaper that has za'atar, the spice in it, and
salt.
You buy it fresh and salt and dip the fresh bread in the za'atar, and it sort of clings to it and flavors it.
They also sell it with this roasted hard-boiled egg.
Do they? Yeah. Roasted hard-boiled egg?
Yeah.
I never had that.
Yeah. It's quite nice, actually. It tastes a bit like caramel.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So there you go. I didn't know about that.
There's more to discover.
It has been such a pleasure having the two of you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Yoram Ottolenghi and Sammy Tamimi. Their book is Jerusalem, and it's one of my picks for the best cookbooks of the year. I guarantee you will be moved to cook from it, And if you head to the Good Food blog, you'll find a recipe for their fattoush salad. I've made it for about, 100 people, and it is delicious. We're going to take a quick 30-second break, and when Good Food returns, I've got more of this year's best books, The Flavors of Burma and the chef behind the Swedish restaurant Faviken, are up next.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food. Naomi Duguid is a gem for the food-obsessed home cook and the armchair traveler alike. In her latest book, Burma, Rivers of Flavor, she plumbs the far-flung culture for culinary treasures that she shares through vivid photographs and enticing recipes. Hi, Naomi.
Hi there.
Why do you refer to the country by its old name rather than Myanmar?
Well, it's the name I think that's most familiar to the outside world. And Myanmar was the name that was imposed by the country had a military coup in 1962, but things got even more intense in 1988. And the new government, the military, imposed this name, Myanmar. And that's okay. A country can change its name, and let's all go along. We went from Ceylon to Sri Lanka and so on. But in this case, they imposed it, and they punished people in the country for using the old name. And I think, anything that's imposed by force like that, no, I don't think so. So those are the two reasons. And now the country's loosened up. And it's really interesting because now in the street in Burma, you can talk to people in Burma, and they'll now use the name Burma interchangeably with Myanmar because they're no longer, subject to being punished.
Has the way that people have been able to engage with food changed at all during these periods of greater and lesser repression?
Evan, I really don't know. I think that politics is out in the street. When things were very oppressive and repressive, what you felt out in the street was a caution and a fear, and people were very cautious with me until they got relaxed with the idea of me being sort of around in the markets. But behind closed doors, which is to say in the kitchen and around the table, the generals have no place in the kitchen, as one friend said to me. And so it's actually the safe place at home. Now, out in the street, there's an awful lot of street food. And that, as people get more prosperous and as things open up, presumably that will get even more elaborate. But it's an extraordinary street food culture, quite different from Thailand. And people depend on food in the street and in tea shops for breakfast, for a snack in the afternoon. Whereas their main meal, they'll eat at home. Wives make sure that they take lunch to their husbands, or it's sort of the older European style of eating where the noon meal was a sacrosanct time and it's the main meal of the day.
What fascinates me about Burma is it's not a small country. It's a pretty big country.
It's big, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's there in between India and Thailand.
And China.
So Burma is sort of at the crossroads of all of these culinary cultures that we love and that are super popular. So seen in that light, how similar and different is Burmese food from either Indian or Thai?
I've been asked the very basic question in much cruder fashion, which is it like Thai or is it like Indian, right? And at that point I say, well, is French food like German or like Spanish? In other words, everywhere is a crossroads. In Burma, I'd say, well, you're in Southeast Asia. And it's also, I should say, a composite of many culinary cultures. There's Shan food and there's Central Burmese food and there's Kachin and so on. There's a number of cuisines and culinary cultures within the country. But you have Southeast Asian ingredients, fish sauce, shrimp paste and so on, and the use of lime juice. You have chilies, but all of that is balanced out with quite a light hand. And at the same time, the flavor base in curries is not the kind of complex sort of wall of flavor that you get when you have those extraordinary blends in curry pastes in Thailand. Instead, it's more layered. So it's more like in Bangladesh or India, Northeast India. You start with oil and a pinch of turmeric and a lot of shallots, and that gives you your sort of undernote. And then you add things after that. So it's its own place, but you can taste and see in the markets, of course, as well, things that you recognize, and then you realize, oh, yes, but they're being put to a distinctive use that is not something I know, and that is a use that is particularly Burma's.
So give me an example of that. Take an example of something that we would recognize and then...
Make it different?
Yes, make it different.
Yes, right, okay. Well, let me talk about, say, a simple beef curry, which is more a Bangladeshi thing than an Indian thing, of course. But in Thailand, you might have it with coconut milk, and there would be a flavor base of galangal and shrimp paste and a number of things that gave a real depth, a real umami, where you couldn't discern the separate ingredients. They'd be pounded together in a paste, and then that paste would be cooked in a little coconut milk and lemongrass in there as well. And then eventually the beef added to simmer with some vegetables or whatever. In Burma, the meat curries tend to be smaller, and every portion is smaller. They're shared. It tends to be not mixed in with lots and lots of vegetables in central Burmese. So you would again start with, as I said before, some oil, peanut oil or unroasted sesame oil, a pinch of turmeric, lots of shallots, maybe some garlic, maybe some ginger, and that would simmer. And then you'd add the beef. Oh, my mouth is watering talking about this. You add the beef, and then you'd slow simmer it, and that's it. And then you put some herbs on top. And you say, well, gee, that's simple. And you might put a little chili oil in there or not. Most often, there's condiments at the table. And the condiments are more complex than the condiments you generally have at the Thai table. It's almost like you get to add more layers of flavor afterwards than you do in Thailand.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, just picture this. I mean, it would be fun to be there with you, Evan, because we could, you know, sit in this restaurant under a tree in Bagan or some other place, but I love eating outside for the rice meal. And we might look at the curries on offer because they're all cooked fresh in the morning in preparation for the rice meal, and the food would be ready around 11:30. And then you sort of turn up. So you'd say, gee, well, let's have an eggplant dish. And I'd say, let's have a pork. And, well, what about that grilled fish? And, yes, but what about those little fried okras? So we'd sit down, and then there'd be a large plate of rice come for each of us, the dishes we ordered, and then about 10 others, 3 condiments, a huge platter of vegetables, raw and just steamed, not dressed, with a dipping sauce, a salad, a soup that's a little bit tart and sort of refreshing, meant to be sipped. And then we'd have this problem, which is a lovely problem to have, which is you sort of take a spoonful of rice, and then you might think, okay, I'm going to spoon on maybe a little of that pork curry. Okay, and I'll take a bite of that. Then what next? And each mouthful is a decision. And so you go around and around. And if you're like me and you don't have a very effective stop sign when you're eating, you just keep going around and around and thinking, oh, what's my next mouthful? Oh, and then that salad, I want that little bit of crunch. And then, it's just an enormous pleasure.
Naomi, once again, thank you so much for the work that you do to bring us foods of places that many of us can't get to.
Well, it's a pleasure talking to you always, Evan.
Naomi Duguid's latest book is Burma, Rivers of Flavor. Find outtakes of our conversation and a recipe on the Good Food blog. My next guest is the 28-year-old chef behind one of the most talked about restaurants right now, and cookbooks, I must say, of the year. His name is Magnus Nielsen, and he helms the 12-seat restaurant Favikan, located on a remote 20,000-acre farm and hunting estate in northern Sweden. His menu is laced with ingredients that are raised, farmed, and hunted in the deep, frosty wilderness. As we head into the winter months, I asked him how he goes about storing vegetables to last him throughout the cold season.
The growing season with us is about 6 months, which isn't that short to start with. But what we keep is, basically we need to keep about 1,400 covers worth of food in store for the winter months. And that translates into something like 3,000 kilos of vegetables. It will start like from more or less now until end of the year. It's going to be continue being a lot of green vegetables like kale and Brussels sprouts and other brassicas that can stand in the garden, even though there is sub-zero temperatures and some snow. It doesn't really bother them. They survive fine anyway. And then after that, we're going to continue with root vegetables. Most of them will have been stored in our root cellar, buried in sand. And then there might be the occasional fermented vegetable or pickled vegetable or dried vegetable or an herb.
Talk to me a little bit about fish and your relationship with it. When I think of being that far north, I imagine that the quality of seafood from the North Atlantic must be quite exceptional.
Yeah, the quality of seafood that we get from our friends in Norway, which is very close, is just about a two-hour drive from the restaurant. It is quite exceptional. And the funny thing is that I actually remember, if you like, for example, the scallops. When I used to work in France, when we got the best scallops ever in, it was always from the same company that I buy my scallops from today. And today it's just 2 hours away from the restaurant.
And so let's say you have one of these incomparable scallops. What do you do with it?
I can start with saying I don't believe in change for the sake of change. So if I have a dish that I really like and that's really good, I don't substitute it until I have to, either because we run out of produce or because we come up with something better. And we have a scallop dish that's been on the menu now for almost 3 years. And it's very simple. We just take the scallop, place it over a griddle, and then we burn some charcoal and juniper branches underneath. When it starts to heat up, we open it, take away everything that you don't eat. We keep what you eat, which is actually the muscle that closes the lid. And then the stuff we took away, we strain, and we get sort of a semi-raw scallop juice, which is poured back into the shell again. And then it's sort of like that. It's very simple.
You also have a close relationship with mushrooms.
I love mushrooms. I love picking them, and I love eating them and cooking them and everything with them.
One of the recipes in the book is for, quote, drying mushrooms. Not fresh, not dried, but drying.
I think that, you know, what is most important to understand when working with produce over a long time, when you kind of keep them for long, is that they will never be more of the produce than they were from the beginning, no matter what you do with them. So if you pick a carrot and you eat it straight from the garden, it is as much carrot as it will ever be. Anything you do to it will make it less of a carrot, but that doesn't necessarily mean it becomes less good. It's just different, you know. And that can be applied to almost any produce, you know. And if you respect that, it can be a lot of fun. What I often do when I cook certain wetter mushrooms, or when I cook mushrooms that have been picked in wet weather, is that I just leave them on a tray for a little while, like, you know, a couple of hours to let them dry a little bit, because they're so much easier to cook and they become more flavorful when there's not a lot of water diluting them. And one time we just left them there a little bit too long, and I tasted one and it was delicious. And then, you know, they came into the menu uncooked like that, just drying.
Do you use a lot of what are called molecular or modernist techniques in the kitchen?
I don't know. I don't think so.
No sous vide for you?
No sous vide for me. No, for me, it's like the techniques are there to support something else. And I don't think that the techniques should make up the sort of larger part of the cooking. They're just there as a tool.
Magnus, it has been such a pleasure talking with you. And your book is just such an enjoyable read.
Thank you.
That was Chef Magnus Nilsson of Faviken, a 12-seat restaurant in northern Sweden. His new cookbook of the same name is quite extraordinary. See a recipe for the scallops cooked over juniper branches that Magnus mentioned on the Good Food blog. What was your favorite cookbook of 2012? Did you have one? Share your picks on my Facebook page. I'd love to know what they are. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. Coming up, why are there so few women chefs? A food writer investigates what is keeping women away from the professional kitchen. Stay tuned.
Jump into a new mode of music discovery with the KCRW Music Mine. It's our first iPad app dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine brings you an interactive experience with a constantly evolving galaxy of audio, video, and photos. Discover by artist, by DJ, or by song, and easily share the music you love with friends. The KCRW Music Mine. Dig into it on your iPad. More info at kcrw.com.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. Today, we've been talking about the best food books of 2012. This next one is not a cookbook, but instead a book about cooks. Back in 2010, food journalist Charlotte Druckman posed the question, quote, "Why have there been no great women chefs?" unquote, in an article for Gastronomica. The piece examined gender issues and a dearth of recognition for women in professional kitchens. Druckman expands her article with her recent book, Skirt Steak, women chefs on standing the heat and staying in the kitchen. She interviewed some of the brilliant women leading some of the country's top establishments. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi.
So I find just that question to be such a provocative and interesting question. Just posing the question makes it seem as if that's true.
Well, that was a rhetorical device that I borrowed from an art historian named Linda Nochlin, who had written an article with that same title, but just about artists in the late 70s. And she did it on purpose to be provocative and really to challenge feminist theory in art history and to say that when you pose questions like that, you do presume that there is a lack of greatness on the part of women. And her idea was to say, why don't we look at how we define greatness? And instead of pinning it on women, let's look at how society has possibly set up impediments to their being perceived as great in the first place.
I think about this a lot because I think about, does greatness mean that you have to be a business person who owns multiple outlets, has published a myriad of books, and has agents and a high media presence? Or can it mean that you just, and here I even just said just, or can it mean that you are a wonderful chef that is making brilliant food that is being enjoyed by many, many people?
I mean, I think the complicated answer probably is both. One of the things I realized when I was researching the book and actually started speaking to all of these chefs was just the word chef itself is so complicated. If I spoke to 73 women, I got 73 different answers for how you define chef. And I think that's because whereas it used to just be a craft, it was so micro. I think of it as being so precise. You know, you work your way through the line and you're going through these tasks and you just become perfect at each one. And at some point you make it to the top of the line and then you become the head of that galley. And, you know, you're not even trained at that point to be a manager. You just kind of have to hope that you're a good manager. Now you look at what chefs are doing today and they are not just in charge of the galley, right? They are owners of restaurants or co-owners of restaurants. Then they're co-owners of multiple restaurants. Then they're on television. They're developing product lines. They're doing cookbooks. This is so at odds with the skill set that we associate originally with just the craft of being a chef. So to get back to the idea of greatness, I think that there are those people that still think about it as that craft, and we can say that excelling in that makes you great, but then we can also look at the world of pop culture and what it looks like to be a chef there, and great can be something very different. It can be being an entrepreneur or being a cookbook author or being a television personality. And a lot of that's generational, too. I think that you find that there are those chefs who came of age before all of this celebrity even started. So they're going to have a very different picture of what it means to do what they do, whereas chefs who are just sort of growing up in the industry now are looking at such a different picture that they're probably going to have more mixed feelings about what it is that they're path might include or what even their ambitions are.
Let's talk about the media portrayal of women chefs for a second, because I feel like the perception of the general population is almost completely dependent upon the media unless they are avid restaurant goers. Could you describe the way dishes are described depending on if it's a man or a woman? Is it a similar thing to how the media treats the way men and women dress?
Yes, a better parallel can be drawn just in terms of the way that women are represented as experts versus the way men are represented as experts on television. And Alex Guarnaschelli said it better than I could say it, but her take on it was that women are presented as experts in the home kitchen, if you know, on most food television shows, whereas men are presented as experts in the professional kitchen. And I think when the food is being described, you see that same point of view coming across. Women's food will be described as rustic or heartfelt, homey, comforting, nurturing even, whereas men's food will often be described in terms that sound more scientific or even artistic, complex, composed, things like that. From what I found across the board, the best way for women to succeed was to go out and do it themselves, and often to do it, you know, with each other. I think Susan Feniger and Mary Sue Milliken are a great example of that. Suzanne Goyne and Caroline Stein are a great example of that. It just seems like there's some kind of strength in it. Doing it alone is hard enough, and doing it alone as a woman where the odds tend to be stacked against you in the first place is, you know, it's certainly not easy.
Now, you just mentioned Mary Sue and Susan and Suzanne Goyne and Caroline Stein, and they're all from here, Southern California. Are female chefs concentrated in any particular area of the U.S.?
There are so many in California. Northern California, especially that San Francisco Bay Area, but L.A. too. I kept asking chefs why they thought there were more female chefs in California. No one really had an answer until Alice Waters. It was so simple, and she was so right. She just said, you know, I think we're farther away from the influence of the Atlantic and France. And so we just didn't have that model to fall back on, which was that chauvinistic setup of the brigade. And she said, so we just kind of did it. You know, and it was no big deal. What I think is particularly interesting about California is that it shows you what it looks like for it to be completely normal, accepted as normal, because it is normal. It's just that people don't see it that way. It's completely normal for women to be chefs and chef owners.
Charlotte, thank you so much. It's a really interesting subject, and you've done it up beautifully in Skirt Steak.
Thank you so much for having me.
Charlotte Druckmann's latest book is Skirt Steak, Women Chefs on Standing the Heat and Staying in the Kitchen. Susan Feniger, who Charlotte talked about just now, is living proof of a truly great female chef. Along with Mary Sue Milliken, Susan brought us Border Grill, which continues to be a fixture on our restaurant scene. And just a few years ago, she branched out on her own with Street, a restaurant that celebrates street food from around the globe. Now Susan has published a street food cookbook to take us around the world in our own home kitchens. I can actually remember, believe it or not, when Susan was preparing for her first trip to India back in 1982. She cites that trip 30 years ago for launching her fascination with faraway flavors.
I believe that first trip to India changed the direction that I went emotionally with food. I mean, all of my training had been in the French kitchen, you know, working in different, wherever, L.A., Chicago, New York, and working in French kitchens, Kansas City, which was one of the best places I ever worked. But I took that first trip to India, and I felt like I was visiting a place that I had lived before. Everything about it, I connected to. The food, without a doubt, it was, you know, strongly, almost everything I ate on that first trip was vegetarian because I was visiting a friend who lived in an ashram over there, and it was all vegetarian. So all the food that I was learning to cook, and it opened my eyes to, you know, spices and ingredients that I'd never seen. So like curry neem leaf and black mustard seeds and tamarind, and it was just a very sort of new direction of food compared to the French kitchen.
And when you came back and you were cooking in more the European vein, did you feel like it was black and white instead of color?
Probably. Because, you know, one of those things that I first, when I took that first trip to India and got off the plane, well, first of all, you arrive in Bombay. Now, remember, this is 30 years ago. I arrived in Bombay at 3 a.m, because that's about the time you typically arrive. And you walk outside of the airport, and all you see a sea of people and the smells of spices and the colors that are everywhere, from bangles and jewelry to clothing. It's just everything is in full-blown color. And it is this richness that I never felt with the French kitchen. There was a richness, a vibrancy that hit me about this cuisine and the strong flavors and everything that made up that cuisine was very different from the French kitchen.
Now, what about technique, cooking techniques? Because for a lot of ethnic foods, for a lack of a better term, the techniques that you learned in your French training were kind of meaningless.
Well, it's interesting. I have to say, of all the training that I had working in French restaurants and going to the Culinary Institute, that the technique part of the French kitchen was what, for me, was the absolute most valuable. That just learning, like, what cuts, like, butchering. I mean, I always was very drawn to butchering, even though I could be a vegetarian. When I was in culinary school, I worked at a fish market, so I filleted fish forever. So techniques in terms of how you make a stock and what's the best way to braise and what cuts to use, you know, all the things that are very basic for us, those techniques that you learn in the French kitchen, actually, I felt like made me a much better cook and much more able to do the things that I now do in the ethnic kitchens. For example, one of our first trips to Mexico, we were learning how to make pozole. And the woman that we were staying with was the mother of our one and only prep cook, because that's all we had room for at the restaurant. And it was in Mexico City, and she was making pozole with pork loin. And, you know, we would never make pozole with pork loin. I mean, you tasted it. It was, you know, the pozole broth was delicious, but the meat was dry as could be. So I think from the French training, you know that, well, you're not going to do it with pork loin. You're going to do it with pork butt, because that's what you would do, or shoulder. And so I think those kinds of lessons and techniques that you learned in the French kitchen, very valuable for even doing this kind of food.
So introduce us to some of the food in street food. Share a couple things with us.
Okay. Well, since we're talking about India, let's talk about the Belpuri. I mean, I love the snacks on the streets of India. I mean, right before I opened Street, I took that trip to India. I hadn't been there in probably 10 years, so for quite a long time. And I took that first trip to India, met my friend Alan over there, and told him the only thing we were going to do, we were going to eat on the street from 8 in the morning till 11 at night every day for 14 days, and that was it. No sightseeing, nothing. That was the prerequisite. And that is exactly what we did. I mean, really, you know, by 6 o'clock, by then you're stuffed, but then it's like, okay, well, we still have another like 4 or 5 hours to eat, so we're back on the street. When we landed, I met him. He lives there, and so I met him in Delhi. So our first day was walking around Delhi and the chaats and in all the big cities, all the different snacks on the street. And Belpuri and Panipuri are two of my most favorite things you can eat on the street.
Describe what they are.
Okay, so Belpuri is a snack that's made with puffed rice. So you can buy puffed rice at any Indian market. You can buy it probably in the grocery store. And then you make a sauce from tamarind and cilantro and chilies. And this is sort of the sauce. And then you can do it. In the book, we sort of do a little bit of a twist where we do it with sweet potatoes. But typically, it's done with Idaho potato or russet or something. You can go a potato like that. And it's mixed with this Belpuri mixture, which you can buy or you can make. But if you go into an Indian market, you can buy the Belpuri mixture, which is puffed rice. And it has like flour tortillas that are crispy. And it might have little chickpea noodles that are crispy in it.
It's like Indian Chex party mix.
Yes, exactly. Perfect way to describe it. Exactly. And it's seasoned typically with a little bit of turmeric, maybe a little bit of chili in there. And so you take that mixture and then you make this sauce that is with tamarind and cilantro and chilies, and of course, a little bit of black salt. It's pink and it's called black salt, and it tastes a little bit like rotten eggs, or it smells like rotten eggs. It has a particular flavor to it that you just crave. And once it gets into this mixture and you mix this sauce with the puffed rice mixture and the potatoes, and then you eat it right away. If you're on the streets of India, it's to order. You walk up there, they mix it with the dry ingredients and the sauce, and then mix it all together, put it in a little, stuff it in a little bit of newspaper. You eat it, and you eat it with your hands, and it's just like the perfect snack food. So we do a version of Belpuri in the book that I love, totally love.
Yum. Thank you so much, Susan.
Thank you, Evan. Always wonderful to be here.
Susan Feniger's Street Food is the latest cookbook by celebrated chef Susan Feniger. We'll have a recipe for her Belpuri on the Good Food blog. Don't go away. I've got one more of my top cookbook picks coming up, as well as a visit from Jonathan Gold. We'll be right back.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Linda Lau Anusasananan has been a food writer for almost four decades, but she never delved into the cuisine of her own heritage until she wrote her new book, The Hakka Cookbook, Chinese Soul Food from Around the World. The Hakka are an ethnic minority from China, currently dispersed in many countries all over the world. Linda visited some of the Hakka diasporas, and she joined me from San Francisco to talk about what she ate. Hi.
Hi, Evan.
Could you start by telling us about the Hakka people?
Well, the Hakka people were basically the nomads of China. And they were forced in that position in the 4th century when invaders forced them from their home. And they led a long history of migration because they had no land to call their own. And eventually, they settled in communities scattered throughout the world.
How does the Hakka food differ from other Chinese food?
I kind of think of it as the comfort food of the working man or the soul food of the nomads. It's very hearty, satisfying, direct. It has strong, robust flavors that come from the use of preserved vegetables, cured meats, and soy sauce. Because they often lived in isolated areas, they needed ingredients that would keep a long time. And salt is a preservative and is used in many of these ingredients. So sometimes people say Hakka food is salty. They may also sometimes describe it as being fatty because they did a lot of hard physical labor. So they needed food that would kind of stick with them. But they also had dishes that sort of balanced that richness. There were often very simple, uncomplicated, plain dishes that emphasized natural flavors. And some people also call it a branch of Cantonese cuisine because the Hakka and the Cantonese were neighbors for a long time.
Would we know certain dishes from the Hakka repertoire that haven't necessarily been labeled as Hakka dishes?
There are certain dishes that are famous Hakka dishes, and a lot of people define the cuisine by that, but there's so much more to what they eat. But one dish is stuffed tofu, and this dish is sort of a creation of migration. When the Hakka moved to the south, they wanted to make the dumplings they had in the north, but they couldn't find the wheat flour to make the wrapper, so they stuffed their filling into tofu. And you can find it in different forms. Sometimes it's deep fat fried. Sometimes it's pan browned and braised. Sometimes it's steamed, and sometimes it's poached. Original filling was pork because they lived inland. But as the Hakka migrated and they moved to areas near the sea, often seafood was added to it. That dish, I think, is one that is probably one of the more common dishes.
Now, I know that your grandmother gave you your first intro to Hakka food. Tell me about her.
Well, she's probably the reason I wrote this book. She came to live with us when I was probably 6 or 7 years old. And we lived in a small town in Northern California called Paradise. We were the first and only Chinese family who lived in town. And Popo came to live with us. And I think of her sort of as now the true Hakka woman. She was a feminist. She was strong. She was a hard worker. She was smart with her money. Even though she was only 4'10", she commanded respect. She used to tell us when we were kids, "You should be proud, you're Hakka." Well, my brother and I just rolled our eyes because we thought, do we really want to learn how to be more unique or more different? We were already the oddballs at school. All we want to do was fit in. But Popo insisted, and so she said that after our American school, she would teach us Chinese lessons. So every day we'd come after school, we'd go upstairs to her kitchen. She'd teach us how to write Chinese characters with ink-filled brushes, and we'd read from Chinese picture books. And then sometimes she would cook dinner for us, like stir-fried vegetables from the garden or homemade chicken soup, or we had a favorite stew of Chinese bacon and potato. But it was those words that she said, "You should be proud, you're Hakka," that kind of inspired me to write this book, because 5 decades later, I still hadn't figured out what that meant.
Linda, it's been fascinating talking to you, and the book is beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing the stories.
Well, thank you, Evan.
That was Linda Lau Anusasananan. Her book is The Hakka Cookbook, Chinese Soul Food from Around the World. We'll have a link to it at our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. And now it's that time we all look forward to each week on Good Food. Jonathan Gold is here. He is, of course, the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. And every week, he comes by Good Food to tell us where to eat. Today, we're discussing the food of chefs Brian Dunsmore and Chris Tominaga of The Heart and the Hunter.
If you were going to have one of those Venn diagrams on food that people think Southern people eat as opposed to food Southern people actually eat, this might be some of the stuff like right in the middle, you know, like boiled peanuts or like fried chicken skin with pepper vinegar or pimento cheese. Southerners are very big on pimento cheese.
Yeah, they are very big on pimento cheese. So describe what pimento cheese is and maybe their take on it.
Pimento cheese is cheese with pimentos in it. I mean, is there a better way to say that?
That's pretty simple.
And they use Hook's cheddar from Wisconsin, which is a really good cheddar. And I assume that they're roasting their red peppers as opposed to getting them out of the can. And it comes out as sort of a loose slurry, where it's not often a loose slurry. And they serve it with hot biscuits, and it's good.
Mm.
They do a shrimp boil, like a Frogmore stew, kind of. You know, big shrimp, they boil just till they're firm. You peel the whole thing heads on with big chunks of andouille sausage, sliced potatoes, corn on the cob. It's something that hasn't been done that much around here.
So are there biscuits?
There are biscuits. And the biscuits here are very controversial.
Why?
In Southern cooking, there are several schools of biscuits, but we can narrow them down into the tender school and the flaky school. And the tender school, probably exemplified by the ones that Shirley Corrier, who's been on the show, loves the best, they're soft. They're super light. I mean, you can almost imagine them floating off the plate. And then there's the flaky school, which has a lot of butter involved, but which separates readily into layers. My family, we come from the flaky school.
I have to say that I am of the tender school. So there you are. There we are.
These biscuits kind of split the difference, because I am almost positive that they are of the tender school, but dipped into melted butter right before they go into the oven, which means that they're crisp on the outside and they have like superficial flaking. And maybe because of the way they put together, there is like one big flake it, which means that you can easily, you know, pop them in half to put butter on them or to put the homemade blackberry preserves on them or whatever else you might care to put on the biscuit. But why not? I mean, why not go over to the enemy camp for biscuits every so often?
Hey, so do the biscuits accompany everything or are they featured in on certain plates?
The biscuits are kind of a thing in themselves. So you could order them by themselves. In fact, they have a butter biscuits and condiments plate, which you might as well get because the condiments include that pimento cheese, which is going to be what you're going to want to have on the biscuits anyway. And it includes that homemade blackberry jam. And it includes a giant swirl. Actually, it looks like a rockabilly hairdo, but it turns out to be made completely of butter.
So take me through a couple of the big plates.
One thing you may not expect to see at a place like this is a good Brussels sprout salad. But they have a really good Brussels sprout salad, which is shaved Brussels sprouts. So they're the little slivery things rather than the sprouts. There are peanuts in there. There are bits of the Hook's cheddar cheese. There is bacon because it couldn't be a southern dish if it didn't have bacon in it. And there's a vinaigrette. And you get each of these things in every bite. I don't know how they manage it. I don't know how the creaminess doesn't manage to be cloying or heavy, but it's a salad that seems to work. If you got your Brussels sprout salad or you got your smoked trout in a jar with, a boiled egg and a toast that was thickly smeared with crushed avocados, you'd be happy.
Very happy.
And for dessert, lemon icebox pie. That's all I got to say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about The Hart and the Hunter, located in the Pali Hotel on Melrose between Fairfax and Crescent Heights. Get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes by simply texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And don't forget, you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant Map, which is on the Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry, on Stitcher and Downcast as well. Good Food is produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laurel Garcia and Sarah Rogozin are our segment producers, and our executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.